person should be your name. You were gone soon as you came. When the first wind shook your branch, cherry blossom, won't you stay just for another day?
My name is Simon Kingston. I'm General Secretary of SPCK, today we've been lucky enough to have our two conversationalists join in both the judging and the awarding of the Michael Ramsay Prize for Theological Writing. So that's been something which has been bringing them together earlier on. One of the wonderful things about the Hay Festival is the way it brings disparate people together to share in their love of literature and of reading. In the world of literature, obviously, they don't come bigger than Shakespeare. And so we're particularly privileged to have today the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Williams. Some of you will have heard him a couple of years ago talking about Dostoevsky, and you will realize how prolific his knowledge is of literature. And he is diseased with the reading bug. And being blessed with a tremendous memory, there's an awful lot in there. And to talk to him, I don't have to introduce Simon Russell Beale, our finest Shakespearean actor, and somebody... our finest Shakespearean actor, and somebody who started as a student of English literature, and so has a love of Shakespeare from the theoretical and the practical, and together we're going to have the opportunity to overhear their conversation. At the end, we'll have a chance for some questions, but first, let's just eavesdrop. Thank you.
Thank you. We thought we might start by saying what we're not going to talk about, and we're not really going to be discussing very much the question of what Shakespeare's actual religious beliefs were, about which there's plenty of argument. We're not even going to discuss precisely how he depicts religion in the plays. There are religious characters in the plays. There are Machiavellian cardinals, eccentric friars, and I'm afraid, idiot vicars. Shakespeare, I think, can claim some of the credit for inventing the idiot vicar as an English literary convention. You could meet some of his vicars in P.G. Woodhouse. But he also assumes, as anybody might have done at that time, that people pray. And one of the interesting things that is one way into the sort of thing we'd like to talk about is watching what happens in Shakespeare when some of his characters pray. Shakespeare, and we'll come back to this, is somebody deeply preoccupied with the lies we tell ourselves, with self-deception. He's fascinated both dramatically and theoretically by what it is you say when you talk by yourself or to yourself. And some of the prayers are a way of seeing what you wouldn't otherwise see. Make what you will of Henry V's prayer on the eve of battle, but you have at least seen something of what you don't otherwise see in that, dare I say it, pretty wooden character. Suddenly, a self-awareness comes through, which makes you read or hear everything else rather differently. And then there's Claudius. Claudius, who is surprised by Hamlet at his prayers. Hamlet won't kill him because he doesn't want to send him to heaven while he's praying. And the irony is, of course, that Claudius is aware, as he prays, of the fact that he's not really praying at all. Or is he? Is his awareness of the impotence of the prayer itself a kind of repentance? But there's something going on there that, again, you don't see elsewhere. And Simon, you might like to think a bit about Claudius.
Because you've thrown about 100 balls in the air and 30 seconds. And we're not going to talk about institutionalized religion, but can I just talk about a bit about Hamlet? Because when I did it, I hate actors who say that, but when I did it, there was a review that said, Hamlet is the least Christian play that this critic knew. I can't actually remember who the critic was. But I remember because our production was extremely steeped in religious culture. And I'd seen a lot of productions which were done in sort of, became very fashionable to do the play set in atheistic totalitarian states for very good reasons. You know, there's a whole thread of espionage and spying and autocratic rule that works very well in that. And in fact, as we know, in Eastern Europe, the play became something of a symbol for the fight against despotism, especially in Romania. But I felt at the time of doing it that I wanted to have a Christian culture around the play because I disagree with the critic in question. But I think it's actually one of the most specifically Christian plays that he wrote. And it sets a particular series of problems. One of the most specific is the prayer with Claudius. The now might I do it, Pat, one of Tom Stoppard's best jokes in Jumpers. His tortoise is called Pat. Now might I do it, Pat. That's quite a specific, localized problem for Hamlet and indeed for Claudius. But it raises a whole series of questions. He seems to, I don't know whether you agree, Rowan, he seems to be playing a lot of games with contemporary religious culture. And I don't know how many of you here would agree with that, but it seems to me not accidental that Hamlet goes to Wittenberg. It's a particular choice of university that has a particular resonance. He gets a visit from his father. And you might be able to correct me this. I'm not quite sure whether Wittenberg would have taught a Protestant theology or a Catholic theology at that time, but he gets a visit from his father who is in purgatory. And he also, at the end of seeing his father, he says to his fellow student, Wittenberg student, and I always thought it was a rather significant line, a very famous line, there are more things in heaven and earth that are dreamt of in your philosophy. He then has to cope with a revenge commission. So he's challenging, Hamlet is consciously challenging a revenge culture that was based on a New Testament stroke, Old Testament set of values, Old Testament stroke, New Testament set of values. And then miraculously, he has that gap when he goes away. And I've always thought, I'm not quite sure whether Shakespeare missed a trick or whether it's a piece of brilliant dramaturgy, that he has something happens to him when he goes to England and he comes back a different man, and we have, and this is the real difficulty for the actor playing Hamlet, we then have him in a philosophical stroke religious state of mind which you have to define as an actor, but which Shakespeare doesn't give you much information about. It seems to be like fatalism. There's the great speech, if it be now, it is not to come, if it be not to come, it will be now. The readiness is all let be. But we also know he's murdered somebody, or commissioned the murder of somebody. So I don't know about you, I don't know whether you could help me with the theology of that, because I find that quite a deliberate cocktail to present in front of an audience of 1600, I would say.
It's a very difficult one, because I think where he ends up is almost a sort of stoic position, rather than a
fatalist,
a religious one.
Yes.
Which may be something to do with the fact that he has indeed internalized the fact that he's murdered someone, that he's known guilt, that he doesn't want to address that guilt in the conventional religious way, and he settles with that rather grim, stoic solution.
Let me. You see, you use the word grim. What I rather did a sort of double think on this one, because I refused to admit that he'd ordered the death of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. So I sort of blocked that from my mind, because I had a desire for him to be the sweet prince who would, in the end, say, let be, with a sense of relief and a sense of calm. What that does, unfortunately, is not only ignore the death of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, but it also makes but I do think this has a validity. It makes the final deaths in Hamlet, this awful thing to say, almost irrelevant. Yeah. And you get that great bloodbath at the end. You think, well, they could all die, they could none of them die. It makes no difference somehow to the philosophical trajectory of the piece. Mm. That somehow we've gone beyond that. So I'm not quite sure what whether it's a grim stoicism or whether it's It's a flight above that. Mm. And I instinctively wanted it to be a flight above that, but perhaps that's sentimental. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, my instinct is to go for the grim there, partly because of all the background you've talked about, where we've seen Hamlet, if you like, studying Protestant theology at Wittenberg, and it would have been, Luther's university. He comes back, something knocks that certainty completely sideways in The Visitation from query purgatory. And yes, it is, but a ghost on his way to sanctification wouldn't necessarily want to expand quite so largely on the duties of revenge, you might think. He doesn't quite know what to do with that. He deliberately tries to stop Claudius going to heaven. It's as if all the conventional lines are jammed. It's like too many messages coming into the call center. And then, as you say, something happens. He does take a decision about Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. And on the far side of that, what's left, I think, something quite bleak. Now, what interests me about that in Hamlet as a whole is, yes, it's certainly all about religious themes, but the resolution is a very strikingly post-Christian one in some ways, which I wouldn't say about Lear, for instance, although people prefer...
Well, it's interesting that you've just sparked a thought in my head, because there are certain things that I feel I can say safely about Shakespeare as a man, one of which I'm sure a lot of you would agree with this. He must have felt jealousy, and we'll get on to jealous characters later. He must surely have felt that. I know he did the whole range, except for mothers, he's not very good at, but he did the whole range of human experience. But jealousy he seems to have a particular interest in. He also has a particular interest in daughters.
Fathers and daughters.
So that you get the sense that was something he had a personal investment in. Now, I wonder, it's interesting, because Rowan just asked me before he came on, we are going to get onto it.
Never.
Before we came, I said, do you think he was Catholic? I said, I'm not going to answer that. but if Hamlet were a jammed play, that's a very interesting idea, isn't it? Because, actually, I did answer it, really. I said I've no idea, but it can't have been a simple... I don't think it could have been a simple one or other, because it cannot have been at that period that people suddenly went, oh, right, I'm Church of England now. Fine, I'm not going to believe in purgatory, or I'm only going to believe in two sacraments, or whatever. So perhaps he was jammed.
Hmm.
Perhaps that was the part of a self-portrait of the play, is that?
I think that has something to say about a complicated play like Measure for Measure as well, where he's not either propagandizing for a particular confessional point of view or satirizing. You can play Measure for Measure, I think, rather glibly either way, but actually, it's another kind of tangle. It's another way in which some conventional religious identities just collide and freeze. And at the end of Measure for Measure, what makes it such a complicated play is that the resolution, as in Hamlet, leaves nobody in a very good place. Unfinished business, unwanted forgiveness. You know, Angelo would prefer to be dead than to be forgiven. And that leaves, I think, on the horizon of Measure for Measure, a sort of Christian stroke spiritual intuition that can never quite embody itself. So it's Isabella who says to Angelo, all the souls that were forfeit once, and he that might the vantage best have took found out the remedy, which is one of the most extraordinary summaries of Christian doctrine in the whole of English literature, never mind Shakespeare. And that kind of hangs over the surface, and at the end, who's found out the remedy? Well, not the Duke, not the characters, and yet there it is, a sort of ungrasped possibility. But we were talking earlier about forgiveness wanted and unwanted, yes. And what happens when forgiveness is offered and not received.
Well, yes, that's another strand. I mean, the most obvious example in my head is the end of The Tempest, when Prospero offers forgiveness to his brother and his brother doesn't speak. And of course, that's again an open, a blank page for the actor to fill in. But it seems when I did it, I found that a fascinating idea about what happens if somebody doesn't want forgiveness, because it becomes again a jam. Yeah. It becomes a log jam. Actually, the more we're talking about this jam idea, because I so many of his plays end up like that. I mean, can I talk a bit about Iago?
Why don't you?
Because this goes back to what you mentioned earlier about soliloquies. When you do a soliloquy, I was told by a very good director that what you do, a very good way of doing them, is to cast the audience in a role. So if you're doing Richard III, you might, these are the choices I made, I'll tell you them, you might say, okay, I'm the leader of the gang. So what you can say before the Lady Anne scene is to say, you'll never guess what I'm going to do now. And murderer though I am, I'm now going to seduce this woman. And at the end of the scene, he goes, see? And that's fantastic. That's leader of the gang. Hamlet, I think, quite simply, sort of wants a friend, really. It's also very interesting to note when characters stop soliloquizing, because it's usually for a quite specific reason. And for instance, Richard III stops soliloquizing except for one soliloquy before the battle at the end. Once he gets crowned, once he gets what he wants, and there's a marvelous irony that I think he no longer feels confident to be the leader of the gang, funnily enough. Hamlet stops soliloquizing, and this is why I think it's not necessarily grim. He stops soliloquizing after his trip back from England, which is when he doesn't need any friends anymore.
I think that's stoic again. But,
but I mean, Hamlet is, I mean, the whole of Hamlet is, on a personal level, is about him being betrayed by a series of friends, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And family. Mm-hmm. Yep. It's one long series, probably the most damaging of which, probably is Gertrude, actually, but Ophelia is pretty damaging as well. So the audience, who's been his constant friend, he suddenly goes, I don't need you anymore. I've gone somewhere where you can't follow, perhaps. Iago is Macbeth's slightly different in his soliloquizing, I think, because he becomes so internalized. But Iago is fascinating because he's the only person I know, and correct me somewhere if I'm wrong, who lies in soliloquy. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about people who deceive themselves, he makes a quite deliberate choice when he talks to the audience of saying, I'll give you a series of reasons for what I'm doing, but I couldn't give a damn whether you believe them or not. And I'll give you five, okay? And it's particularly foul because it's the breaking of a pact between the audience and the actor. And I think that's part of his power. And I think he's the only character who has absolutely no understanding of love. And I think is the only character who quite genuinely, in theological terms, we can say is in hell. In hell now. Mm. He ends with the, as a lot of you will know, it ends with the very chilling words, when Othello says, why did you do what you did? And he goes, what you know, you know. I don't know what that means. It's something like the sounding of a very deep bell on that line, which is not what appears on the surface of the line.
I think that's absolutely right, that Iago is in that sense a soul in hell, because he could not receive absolution if it were offered, in a sense. He wouldn't know what it meant. It's not just a matter of refusing forgiveness out of shame or humiliation like Angelo's. What would forgiveness mean? Who knows? Who knows?
Absolutely.
He's not there. But thinking of soliloquies and hell, Macbeth goes on soliloquizing, doesn't he? Is he in hell? Because there's some sense in which, after Macbeth says, you know, I could not say amen, he's stuck in my throat. He's choked. He's literally choked. He can't move. And from that point on, he's sort of going round and round in circles, trying to find words for what he can't rationalize or justify to himself. Is that hell?
The only decent essay I wrote at university was about Macbeth. So, although I wasn't myself a very good Macbeth, I have a particular affection for the play. And I think he's unique amongst Shakespearean tragic heroes, because he goes to a place where his own attitude to his own death is unique. He has no desire to die at the same time he wants to die. And I think that's a very, very odd position for a Lear to find himself in, or a Hamlet, or an Othello to find himself in. So it's not where they would end up. Macbeth, there's two things about Macbeth that I think are fascinating, well, more than that, but the first is that he becomes, you talk about standing still, his life reduces him to absolute stasis.
Yeah.
And this is linked in with children too. Can I do a quick parenthesis about Iago again? Because children, it's interesting about Shakespeare's source material, and I've never had to say this really in public, it's Cynthio. Hecatomithi. And it's a series of short stories, one of which is the Othello story, Desdemona story. But Iago in that is rather glamorous, extremely handsome, sexually active, sort of Richard III-ish, not the Richard III is handsome, but that sort of figure. Sexy, charismatic. He's also got a child. And it's significant that Shakespeare decides to get rid of the child when he wrote his version of Othello. Emilia and Iago, as far as we know, are childless. Anyway, the Macbeth's famously a childless. He ends up in a world without children, because he then gets to a stage, we can't look at the past, because that's where a dead child is, a dead king.
Yep.
A marriage that suffered a trauma that he thought he could cure, I think, by killing the king and becoming king. In the future, he can't have an heir. He doesn't want any children in Scotland, basically. Yep. We see a tiny microcosm of that with the death of the Macduff children. And he ends up centered, I suppose, on the tomorrow speech, but he ends up in, as you say, in that circular, non-productive, it's where Iago is as well. But Iago is so busy that he can disguise it. Macbeth literally, literally cannot move, I don't think. There was a, some of you have heard me speak, I'm sure, before, but at university I saw a play by Athol Fugard called Statements After an Arrest Under the Immorality Act. And Tilda Swinton, as a student, was playing this woman whose lover had been taken away under the Immorality Act because he was different skin colour. And she was left on stage naked, and she said, I've always remembered it, she said, if I move an inch, then the full horror of what's happened to me will begin to roll. And I think Macbeth is doing
it.
I think he's, there's also a description in Solzhenitsyn's First Circle of Stalin, in his 10-foot wall room in the Kremlin, in a tiny bed, not moving. And I think that's what happens to Macbeth. He becomes paralyzed.
That's right. And a lot has been written about the imagery of blood-stained children in Macbeth. But for me, one of the great images in it is pity like a naked newborn babe striding the blast.
Yeah.
Because that extinction of the future, the murdering of the children, that's the murdering of the possibility of pity. Forgiveness, again, any drama that looks towards forgiveness has got to find ways into the future, ways of, well, ways of recovering the dead child, which is onto Shakespeare's late plays, where that's exactly what happens again and again, as though he can't stop writing about the loss of children and what it might mean somehow, incredibly, magically, absurdly, to recover that.
Yeah.
And they're absurd plays, the late plays.
To just mention that particular image, it's phantasmagoric, that image. I mean, a naked newborn babe striding the blast. He must be huge.
Yes.
I had this image of this enormous baby.
Yes. Zooming down the sky, actually.
I can't think of an animated film that has one of those sort of grotesque babies in it. But of all the things to pick a baby, you think, wow. And then you turn it into something. The other thing I meant to say about Macbeth is that bizarrely, he finds his voice. Mm-hmm. And this is. We will get on to the late plays, but it links back to Iago. His Macbeth's wife says at one point, I don't understand what you're saying. And
yes.
It's after a particularly lyrical passage
yes.
that he's done. And there's something that he finds fulfilling about what he's done. You know, this is a famously silent man. He barely speaks in the first act, except for his soliloquies. He doesn't talk to other people. And then suddenly he murders the king, and out comes this stuff. And there's something temporarily enjoyable about it. And I think part of what Iago is saying to Othello is, you enjoyed that, didn't you? Mm-hmm. You indulged something in the black side of your soul that was actually momentarily pleasurable. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Just hanging on to the Macbeth thing for a moment. I think that particular exchange, when Lady Macbeth doesn't understand, and he, as it were, discovers he doesn't need her to understand. Be innocent of the knowledge, dearest Chuck, till thou approve the deed. One of the most chilling lines, I think, in Macbeth, because he's saying, actually, I don't need you for stimulation and courage and sexual satisfaction anymore. What I've done is what sustains me in a horrible way.
The lady's ill. I always think when people feel unwell in theatre, they should stop. Because the last thing you want to do is do it quietly. companionship. There's a scene in Othello when Iago reduces Othello to a fit. Mm. Do you remember? Mm. And they start completing each other's sentences. It's very odd. And I think you talk about companionship. Iago certainly doesn't need Emilia. And as you say, Macbeth doesn't need Lady Macbeth. But Iago, oddly, this is also going back to what you know, you know. I think he and Othello become the same organism. It's an indulgence. It's an indulgence in the very worst that one can do and feel. Mm. And, you know, so. Mm. But the late plays. Right, let's get to something redemptive. Again, I think this is a moment when you can see a peek into Shakespeare's biography. I don't know what children meant to him, but something grew in his life whereby they became... It's not the children of the first 18 sonnets. It's not, I better breed somebody who's exactly like me. But it's to do with a love being invested, your love being invested in something in the future, I think. I think that's probably what it's about.
And a future being given back when you assume there wasn't one, and it's not the future you'd have chosen or planned, but it's happening. Perishes, I think, which when I saw it again recently, the first time in about 20 years, I was more moved than I'd ever expected to be, because I'd forgotten just how deeply it's a kind of reworking of Lear with another kind of conclusion, and part of that obsessional going over the lost daughter theme. And it comes out even more than in Lear, the pure grace of recovery, the relationship you thought had been lost forever, sacrificed forever, the relationship which you have sacrificed for your own ego or whatever in Lear, and it's given back. And it's anarchic, it's unrealistic, and yet just colossally powerful, I think.
Explain to me the theology of the end of Winter's Tale.
How long have you got?
I mean, because when I was doing it, there was all that stuff about that I was reading about grace.
Yes.
Which again is that a peculiarly Catholic thing, or is that a Protestant?
Not peculiarly Catholic. I think the notion of anarchic, causeless grace is much more Protestant. You have no idea why this happens or how it happens, it just happens. And something like that is going on at the end of The Winter's Tale, because Leontes, well, he's repented in a sense in that he's made his life hellish in the intervening period. There's no way of bringing back the dead son. And
again, you see, he muddies the waters, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Because the dead son is always there.
And I think ought to be somehow a presence, I don't know how you do it theatrically, at the end. Because again, it's not a glib, all the ends tied up conclusion. But somehow into all this comes that extraordinary moment of what you thought was stasis, the statue, actually moving. Things move. I think that's how grace works at the end of The Winter's Tale. Not it's all forgotten and forgiven, not it was okay after all, but things move. Things unfreeze.
It is required you do Awake Your Faith, that famous line. I mean, is that, again, a theological requirement? To Paulina, it seems to be a requirement, doesn't it? That he can't possibly see Hermione until he's got faith.
So until he's let go of something and imagined that there might be a movement.
Right.
Which Macbeth, of course, can't do.
Yeah, or Iago.
Yeah.
I always found, I have to confess to you all, I think Winter's Tale is possibly one of the most beautiful miracle of a last scene. And A friend of mine said, you know, Shakespeare always has the tingle factor. If he's, you know, if you do it properly, he's got the tingle factor. And if there's any scene in the whole of the canon that has the tingle factor, it's that last scene of Winter's Tale. But it does worry me, because I'm not quite sure what Shakespeare's trying to say here, because it can't happen. I think that's, it really bugged me throughout the whole time of playing it, that I thought, yeah, it'd be lovely if you did something terrible and you could be forgiven and know that you're forgiven. And I mean, oddly enough, actually, when we did it, Hermione refused to give me her hand, which I'm not sure is right, actually. I think actually what Shakespeare was writing was a full reconciliation. But there's something, I couldn't decide whether it was a sleight of hand on Shakespeare's part, so that we all go at the end, oh, isn't that marvellous? But don't think too hard about it, because actually, this can't happen. Or am I being too literal?
No, I think that connects a bit with what I meant by saying there's an anarchy about the late plays in all sorts of ways. The anarchy of the plots, which are dreadful.
Simply, yeah.
And, you know, they're like soap opera plots, sort of improvised almost scene by scene, and it gets more and more complicated, and at the end you have to have some extraordinary cutting of the knots. But I think what it comes down to in Winter's Tale is, no, of course it can't happen, but what if there were a future for someone as guilty as Leontes? What if? It would feel like this. It would feel like a statue coming to life. It would feel like the daughter coming back from exile. It would feel like dot, dot, dot. And I suspect that's what he's pushing us into. Not, as I say, not a happy ending, but, you know, what, for goodness sake, what do Leontes and Hermione say to each other that night after dinner?
Well, let's start at the beginning. 16 years ago. I wonder whether part of the tingle factor is to do with the fact that it plumbs into a very, perhaps I'm displaying too much of my own psyche here, but it plumbs into a very fundamental human need of being able, of being forgiven.
Yes.
Of being able to say the past is quite genuinely wiped clean. And I wonder whether that's a fundamental human desire.
It is, but I think what Shakespeare is refusing to do at the end of The Winter's Tale is to wipe it clean. It's past, but it's real. You know, Hermione is the one to whom these things have been done. She's the one whose son has been brought to his death by the father. That's not going to go away, but it doesn't stand still. And I think
she famously doesn't talk to him, of course.
Of course.
Only talks to Perdita.
Yeah. But, something moves, and I think in Cymbeline as well, another ludicrous and deeply moving ending. Pardon's the word for all. That's where you've got to. And I remember Mark Rylance once saying that the thing about Cymbeline was it was the only one of the so-called Roman plays that was really fully set in sort of Christian period. You wouldn't know it, but yes. Something in the tectonic plates shifted, and the gods by crosses lead us in Cymbeline. You suddenly think, hang about, something is leaking into the language here about absolution, about movement, which is not, as I say, wiping clean, but is unfreezing. Maybe absolution is that unfreezing. We talked about the stasis of Macbeth or Iago, and I would say a kind of stasis, even in Hamlet at the end, and then something moves. And I suppose that's why, personally, I find Lear more in tune with that thought about absolution than the others, because although, you know, he dies, but he's moved by that time. Yeah. It's okay for him to die because he's moved.
Yeah.
And the relationship that he thought he had wrecked is almost magically, not as magically as in Pericles or whatever, given back. And after that, so to speak, it's okay to die.
That's interesting, because the I suppose at the end of Othello, you're not quite sure whether the overarching egotism of Othello still hasn't gone. It's again a sleight of hand on Shakespeare, a brilliant sleight of hand, because actually in performance, I think most people are tremendously moved by those last scenes. Mm. It's only in retrospect that you go, hang on, but he talked a lot about himself, didn't he? But I agree with you that perhaps Lear is the only, I only know Lear from another perspective, which is from Edgar, which actually we haven't got time to talk about Edgar, but that's a very interesting part that I didn't do very well. But I knew what I wanted to do, and that's an extraordinary figure of I would say probably Christian, a Christian figure, actually, of a person who facilitates another person's learning. And the weird thing is that we never know who he is. That's why it's such a difficult part, because actually don't know who he is. Right? Do we need to open up?
Yeah, well, unless you want a quick word about Much Ado About Nothing. I know you wanted to talk about Benedick. I'm talking about tragedy a lot. There are other plays.
I wanted to mention Much Ado About Nothing. It's so easy because I'm in the fascination of Shakespeare to talk about some big things and you know, redemption and grace and hell and Much Ado About Nothing. I think Benedick is the bravest man that he ever wrote, and I always want to say that, because also the other thing about Benedick is that Beatrice is so enchanting, and Benedick is always seen as a bit of a twit, and he's clever and he's sharp, but he's a twit. He doesn't understand women, and you know. But it's the most sexually segregated play that he wrote. It's very interesting. When we rehearsed it, I literally got to the first performance and I hadn't met half the women in the company. Well, any of the women in the company except for Zoe Wanamaker, who was playing Beatrice. Unheard of. I mean, literally, the men and the women are completely separated, and then. And very carefully at the beginning of the play, it's a couple of mentions of the fact that Benedick doesn't like dueling. Just thrown away. He does that extraordinary thing of changing camp. It's the most amazing thing to do when you're on stage, because you're in the chapel, hero's been abandoned at the altar, they've had their big family row, the men have all stormed off in a great sort of macho cloud, and Benedick remains, does that possibly the best love scene that Shakespeare ever wrote in six lines. I mean, just amazing piece of writing. Says he loves Beatrice, Beatrice says he loves him, then she says, kill Claudio, and you suddenly realise that that Benedick has, switched sides, and he will now go off and do something he absolutely hates, which is challenge his best friend to a duel. And I think it's profoundly moving, and it's profoundly moving on an absolutely human level. Because it's the one play where I don't think, I mean, I know he does a death trick, but it's sort of within the realms of possibility. Whereas at the end of Twelfth Night, he plays a magic trick, doesn't he? At the end of Comedy of Errors, he plays a magic trick. The late plays, that shimmer that he does, which however you explain it, is still magical. In Much Ado About It, it's sort of believable. You could just
it's
about
believable. It's two grown-up people.
That's the other thing, it's two grown-up people.
Coming to a prosaic, but deeply ethical, deeply transforming relationship. It's, in that sense, it's more about marriage, I think, than almost any of the other romantic comedies.
But you say prosaic, the sex will be marvellous.
Yeah.
I tell you that. It really will. You know, they'll have a fantastic... Claudio and Hero, on the other hand.
Don't
wish them well.
Yes, straight to relate, I think.
What a point to interrupt. Now we have some time for questions. May I just ask, please, when you ask questions, can you keep them brief so we get maximum time for a number of questions and answers in between? So please make your questions as short as you can. Now, who would like to ask the first question? If you raise your hand, the microphone will come in your direction.
Somebody there, Simon.
All right, yes. Down here in the front, can we have a microphone here, please? Right in the front. Thank you. It's on its way.
Thank you. Shakespeare embodies humanity. He expresses humanity. That includes religion and philosophy. But I don't know that you can narrowly define him. You could call him a humanist. I don't think, but you'd agree with me, that you can say that he's a Catholic humanist or that he's a Protestant humanist, or maybe that you can even say that he's a Christian humanist. Do you agree?
About 85%, I think. I don't think it tells you a great deal about what matters in Shakespeare to settle whether he was a Catholic or a Protestant or whatever. I think, for what it's worth, he probably has a Catholic background and a lot of Catholic friends and associates. That imagery, that world is very familiar to him. He uses it a lot, as in Hamlet. The extent to which I want to call him a Christian is not, I think, trying to kidnap him for the tribal trophy war, but A, because pretty well everybody at that time was some sort of Christian, and B, there are things about Shakespeare which you can't really begin to understand without understanding something about these notions of anarchic forgiveness, free grace, whatever. And that line I quoted from Measure for Measure about the one who, he who would, might the vantage most have took, found out the remedy. God, who has everything, if you like, going for him in terms of resource and leverage, is the one who solves the impasse of human horror by becoming powerless. Now, that's Christian. How much he believed it, what he did about it, I don't quite know. I don't think he was saying his prayers in church every Sunday. In fact, we know he wasn't. And he wasn't a very nice man in many ways, Shakespeare. It's always very shocking, that, but, you know, the late Shakespeare hoarding grain and buying up property in Stratford, it's not terribly attractive. So if he was a Christian, he wasn't a saint, but you don't expect that.
Yes, I've nothing to add, but who is the expert on that? I mean, it's impossible to tell, isn't it? I mean, I would be less concerned than Rowan about whether he's a Christian. Well, I mean, Rowan's not concerned whether he's a Christian or not, but he obviously knew his Bible. We know that. We know he noticed Matthew's Gospel very, very well. You know, it's impossible now to distinguish between what was culturally part of his makeup and what was he actually believed in. I mean, I do think the end of Hamlet is quite an interesting one, because our interpretations of that are different, that I would say it's less grim and more humanist and lighter.
Thank
than
you.
That.
Next. Here in the front.
In fact, that was my question. But I just wanted to thank you so much for your insights, for facilitating our learning, for adding dimensions to a reading of the plays. And that was my question, basically. Do you think that, even though you said you weren't going to talk about Shakespeare's religious standpoint, this is too good an opportunity to miss? And do you think that it can be summed up in one sentence, as it were, or do you think that it's multifaceted and that all of the plays contribute to a kind of global religious standpoint, in fact, that they are the sum of all the parts?
Well, as you said, the answer to part of the question has already been given. I tread very carefully on Shakespeare biography, because actually, the awful thing to say is I don't really care. I'm fascinated by it, but in the end, I always sit there thinking, look, by the time, I remember Nick Heitner saying to me, who runs the National Theatre, he said, you know, by the time we're dead, we'll have proved that half the plays weren't written by him. And we know it's already started. I mean, not started, it started 100 years ago, but we know that Middleton wrote substantial parts of the plays. We know that George Peel wrote substantial parts. We know that... And it doesn't make any difference to me at all. I would love to think that the man that I have spent so much time worshipping from afar, that he was responsible for the best bits. But I bet by the time I'm 70 that a substantial amount of his work will not be attributable to him anymore. And so be it. And it really doesn't fuss me. So I have to say that, I would sense that if I know anything about actors, they probably haven't changed much over 300 years, and I bet he wasn't a churchgoer.
Well, as I said,
I'm not. So I, and as somebody once said, you cast Shakespeare in your own image, don't you? And I think we're all allowed to do that.
Okay, so as a sort of bearded, balding figure. yes, and I certainly don't think he was a devout churchgoer. I do think, though, that let's just say the world of the plays, and not only the plays but the sonnets too, isn't a secularist world.
No.
It's a world in which the dimensions of humanity around are very deep, very, very mysterious, and do open out on something which you can only call God. Because whatever you think about his doctrinal affiliations, his sacramental practice, all the rest of it, he wrestles with human questions with intensely ambivalent, many-layered approaches to humanity and ends up saying, well, there's a great deal more to all this than some might think, and it is required you awake your faith. You know, some trust in that mysteriousness is part of what the plays are about. And I don't, as I say, make a point-scoring claim about that. You know, the greatest of English playwrights or greatest consortium of English playwrights or whatever was a Christian of some sort. No, but that here is the imagination at full stretch, which seems unable to cope without something of the sacred.
I wonder what he thought about Christopher Marlowe. It'd be interesting to know, wouldn't it?
I think he loathes, wouldn't he?
I don't know. Well, sorry, I should loathe his writing. No. You know, he was defined as an atheist, although, of course, even Christopher Marlowe presumably was working within... He wouldn't be what we recognise as an atheist, no. I wouldn't guess. So I wonder what he thought. I wonder whether he... I've got this image
jealousy.
Of him being...
Jealousy.
Jealousy.
Don't you
jealousy.
Think? I mean, he tries to do the Marlowian line at times, and after a decade or so, thinks, oh, stuff it, I'm going to do my own thing.
Yeah. Hmm.
We have a question in the front here.
Are there any of Shakespeare's characters who you would particularly identify with?
I'd love to say I could identify with Benedict. but having just described him as the bravest man in there, I'm not as brave as him. Any actor who plays Hamlet, and it's completely... conventional thing to say, but I was talking to somebody who I think is in the audience, Ben Crystal, who's about to play Hamlet, and here at the festival, and somebody said before I did, they said, you know, it'll change your life. I can't remember. It was an actor who'd just done it. And you thought, oh yeah, and it does change your life. It changes your life because I think it requires an actor to stand as Simon Russell Beale or Mark Rylance or Ralph Fiennes or Ben Crystal, you know, who's going to be doing it, to stand on stage as themselves, oddly. So it's a very weird dynamic in that play, which is that you end up... This is why I don't think it's grim. I think you stand on stage in psychologically naked and you expose yourself... to the audience as yourself. It's a weird journey in a way that is not required, I think, of any other part. And I think that's why it's become special. So if I said I'd identify with Hamlet, it's not because I'm brilliant like Hamlet, it's because you, rather like fashioning Shakespeare in your own image, you fashion Hamlet in your own image. I'd like to be as glamorous as Cleopatra, but that's another... That's, that's another world. Yes. I cast beyond the moon and dream of things impossible, but there you go.
Yes, as a non-actor, at least in that sense, I couldn't easily identify. The only two Shakespearean parts I've ever played in student productions were Dogberry and Theseus. You'd draw your own conclusions from that. Can't say I identified much with either of them. It's not so much identifying for me as a reader and an observer as being drawn in and compelled by characters. And for me, I suppose partly the result of doing King Lear at A-level. Lear just holds me as the figure I most constantly want to explore and think about. And in a strange way, Macbeth also. Not through identifying with him, which is probably good news, because you don't really want a serial killer as Archbishop of Canterbury. but there's something about that, about the complexity of motive, the complexity of language, the fact that the frozenness of Macbeth still generates image after image after image after image, which, again, I just find compelling.
The only one I never had sympathy with, just to do a second answer, was Iago. Even Leontes, I thought, actually, he's trying to obey the rules. He's trying to behave like a reasonable man. It's just that he, as Shakespeare writes, he's diseased. But Iago was the only one that I felt beyond the sympathy of the person playing him.
More question? I think we have time for one more. This side.
At the back.
you say actors haven't changed much across the centuries, and a lot of actors in the modern day flirt with all sorts of, or get involved with all sorts of religions. Do you think there's any evidence that Shakespeare flirted with whatever options were around then? I mean, you know, the witches, or identifying with classical religions or value systems.
There was that book written about the Rosicrucian thing, wasn't there?
There usually is.
Is Rosicrucian Christian? I think it is, isn't it?
Sort of. Very sort of.
I don't know. I mean, it'd be interesting to know whether they always say that about Macbeth, that the black magic is genuinely researched, as it were. But I see no evidence. No, I don't see any evidence of any particular other value system being employed directly, yeah. To be honest.
No, I think that rather hard-headed side of Shakespeare means that he will look with interest. I guess that if he knew anything about the sort of hermetic magic that was around in Elizabethan times, he would have said, that's fascinating, tell me a bit more. And it would have all been woven in. But that he wasn't somebody who gave his heart very easily to systems of any sort. Or
I mean,
solutions.
As far as one can tell, he was conservative with a small c, wasn't he? When he went back to that little town in Stratford, and he was very, very interested in the divine right of kings being properly exercised.
And yet, even with that, he can't stop himself showing you what's wrong with it.
Yeah.
That's, isn't it, part of the part of extraordinary experience. Character of, yeah. of Shakespeare? He wants you to see the other side all the time. He will talk about the divine right of kings, and he will show you exactly why it's a bad idea. Richard II.
Yeah.
And show you how it's never just an ideology, it's also about persons, about failed and failing persons, about potential disaster, about cost and loss, and all the things that human life is about.
I'm also thinking about Cassius too, because I found Cassius extremely sympathetic, in the sense that so interesting with Shakespeare that you can, if you get rid of your preconceptions about a part, I'm sure some of you heard me say this before, but if you get rid of them, you can actually try and start from scratch. And some end up with rather interesting things. Like with Cassius, I suddenly thought, what if he, you know, he's always played as Machiavellian manipulation. I thought, actually, what if he's absolutely genuine? Mm. there's no manipulation at all going on. It's, I mean, part of the fact that he's dreadful at it, I think. Yes. And he's a panicker, and he's not a very good political worker, you know, player. So suddenly becomes a rather sympathetic character. And it's interesting, he...
More than Brutus.
Sort of oddly more than Brutus,
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
He also, he threatens suicide in every scene. I'm sure some of you have heard me say this. Mm. This is my discovery, and I'm very proud of it, because I haven't seen any academics mention it, but he threatens suicide in every scene, except the last one where he actually does commit suicide. And it's interesting when you have to think, well, what do I do with that? Is it a hysterical, you know, rather queeny sort of reaction to everything, or is it genuine? Is he really, 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 really worried about Caesar? And I will kill myself if he becomes king. You know, and then suddenly the whole thing flips, and it becomes a very sympathetic portrayal of somebody who's not willing to follow down the despotic route. So.
I'm afraid our time is up now. Our revels must end. sorry. We've been extraordinarily informed and certainly entertained as well, and it was nice that we ended on a question and a laugh. But please, will you just say thank you to the Archbishop of Canterbury and Simon Russell Beale.
Thank you very much. I've got one at last. Thank you.